but from the nearby army of New York's finest, who, I feel certain, await only a flicker of Tarzan's eyelashes to storm the building in thunderbolts of moral righteousness. Now, if I stand on the toilet, the pig might just fly. I've got the figure for it, thanks to poverty and cigarettes. On the other hand, who wants to die in a ventilation shaft? You may be surprised to hear this, but when I first arrived on Manhattan Island 2 years ago, wearing my heart on my sleeve and 10 additional pounds around my hips, I had never once sipped the nectar of juniper, nor breathed a leaf of tobacco. It's true. My dear mother had scraped and saved to send me to a nice Catholic school 50 miles away, and I'll be damned if those nuns didn't have their wicked way with me. A year of college didn't improve matters, what with the Wagnerian door mother and the scarcity of men. So there I stood in the middle of Pennsylvania Station, in a hat and a sweet pink coat, clutching the tiny valise that contained my all, just like every starlet who's ever set foot in her land of dreams. And I thought I had made a terrible mistake, that I would never belong in this sea of stink and vice, this hive of determined bees lining their cells with honey. And then I tasted the honey, honey, and I started to understand what New York City was all about. Hallelujah! I started to glimpse my place in the hive, how each tiny insect contributed her mite of pollen, how grand it was to live in a hive like this at all, even if your cell measured 1 inch square and lacked proper ventilation, even if you had to pawn your favorite shoes each month to pay the milkman for a quart of milk, even if, well, you get the idea. The point of Manhattan is that you occupy a cell in the hive at all, that you belong, that you have your seat at the Christopher Club bar, and that seat, if you're clever, can propel you from a tapping pool downtown to a swank party uptown to the front of a camera in a tatty village studio, so any man with a nickel in his pocket can admire the tilt of your tits. And I'll be damned if I'm ready to give up my seat just yet. I set one foot on the seat of the toilet, brace my hand on the wall, hoist my bones upward and upward to the hole in the ceiling, filling my lungs with the reek of sewage, and then, of course, comes the exact second the boots clamber down the hallway, and the door flies open, and the powder room fills with gentlemen of blue suits and billy clubs, unamused by my predicament. 5. About those nuns. Maybe I was a little unfair a moment ago. There's nothing like a good convent education, as I often tell my gentleman friends, and even my lady ones. Your knuckles may suffer, and your knees may burn, but the poetry and the multiplication tables are yours for eternity. Along with the guilt, but who doesn't need a little shame from time to time to keep her on the straight and narrow? Anyway, there was this one sister, Sister Esme, who loved me best, and to prove it, she rapped my knuckles the hardest and sent me to penance the longest. When I turned 17, she called me into her office, about as inviting as an Assyrian tomb, and gave me a beautiful Bible, in which she had painstakingly marked all the passages she thought relevant to my character, such as it was. You can imagine. She told me that, of all the girls who had filtered through her classroom, I was the most unruly, the smartest mouthed, the least tractable, the most irreligious and argumentative. And she fully expected to hear great things from me. She also said, assuming a terribly serious mien, that she had one single piece of advice for me, which was this. I owed confession only to God. Not to my fellow man, not to my instructors, not even to my parents, this accompanied by a significant slant to the eyebrows, and most especially, her voice grew passionate, not to any person, howsoever persuasive, howsoever threatening, belonging to the judiciary branch of the government, whether local, state, or federal. My conscience belonged to my Maker, and to Him alone. Did I understand? Well, naturally, I didn't, Lord Almighty, I was only 17. I had so little experience of the world outside the walls of that school, but in the usual way of childhood advice, Sister Esme's words returned to me with new meaning, as I slouch upon a metal bench in my cell at the 6th Precinct, cheek by miserable jowl with the other female patrons of the Christopher Club that January midnight. Now, I don't mean to startle you, but I've never landed in the pokey until tonight, though you might say the visit's overdue. I guess the place is about what I expected. We're a tawdry lot, sunk into nervy, silent boredom. Dottie's chewing her nails. Muriel's wearing a loop of sequins on her sleeve, such as it is. One girl, gaunt and ravishing, leans cross-armed against the damp concrete wall, staring right through the bars to the tomato-faced policeman on the chair outside. She's too beautiful for him, and he knows it. Looks everywhere but her. I don't know her name, but I've seen her around. She's wearing a shimmering silver dress, ending in a fringe, and her arms are white and bare and cold. Someone once told me she was Christopher's girl, and I guess it might be true. Nobody ever bothers her for a smoke and a dance, for example. She sits by herself most nights at the end of the bar, staying up past bedtime, sipping cocktail after cocktail, trailing the never-ending cigarette from her never-ending fingers, disguising the color of her eyes behind ribbons of smoldering coal. The coal's now smudged, but the smolder remains, liable to ignite the poor cop's tomato head any second. She gave her name as Millicent Merriweather. I pay close attention to these details, see, but then none of us told the book and rookie our genuine monikers. Where's the fun in that? And I'll be damned if this vamp is a Millie. There's a clock on the wall above Tomato Head's cap, a damn slow clock if you ask me. For the past half an hour, I've amused myself in priming my nerves for every twitch of the minute hand, moving us 60 seconds farther into the morning. And each time I'm early. Each time I teeter on the brink, unable to breathe, thinking, now, and now, and now. Until finally, the stinking hand moves. As amusements go, it's a real guess. Millie the Vamp turns her head and regards me from the corner of one pitying eye. I shrug and resume my study. By the time 3 o'clock jumps on my spinal cord without any kind of notice from our hosts, without any sign at all that anyone's left alive in the rest of the 6th Precinct station house, I've had it. I call out to Tomato Head. I don't guess a girl could bum a cigarette if she asks nicely. He makes this startling movement, clutches his cap, turns from tomato to raspberry. No, I guess rules are rules. I lift my hands and stretch, an act that creates an interesting effect on my décolletage, don't you know? I don't mean to be a nuisance, officer, but I do have a breakfast appointment I'd rather not miss, and this fellow happens to prefer me scrubbed up and smiling, if you know what I mean. Tomato Head looks to the ceiling for relief. Now, don't be embarrassed. We're just a mess of girls here, the nicest girls in the world. It's a shame, the way they turn honest girls into criminals these days. Don't you think? Oh, shut your flapper, Jen, Dottie says crossly. It ain't his fault. No, of course not, poor little dear. He's just doing his job. Why, I'll bet he's seen the inside of a juice joint to himself when he's not on duty. He doesn't look like teetotal to me, no sir. He looks like the kind of fella who enjoys a nice time on the town, likes to make a little whoopee. Says you, don't you think? A friendly-faced cop like that. I'll bet he's on our side. Him? Sure, because why? Because it's the first time the joint's been raided, isn't it? And Christopher's been around since the start of the Dark Ages, so... Oh, give it up. So I say, there's a rat. A rat in the house. Somebody squealed, didn't they? Officer? Tomato Head chews his lips and looks ashamed. You see, someone ratted Christopher out. I'll bet it's someone on the inside, too. I'll bet... Millie turns so fast, her fringed hem takes a minute to catch up. Be quiet, Ginger, for God's sake. You don't know a thing. In all the excitement, my legs have come uncrossed. I sit back against the wall and lift the right pole back over the left, slide my arms back together over my cold chest, bounce my shoe a little, bounce, bounce. Seems I'm right, then. The question is, who? She narrows her eyes until they just about disappear between the charcoal rims, turns away and says into thin air, No, the question is whom? La-dee-da, someone's got an education. So do you, Ginger. I'm just not ashamed to show it. There's the little emphasis on the word ginger, which those of you born with fire in your hair will recognize. I consider the back of Millie's neck, and the exact tender spot I'd stick a needle if she were one of those voodoo dolls they sell in seedy little Harlem shops. Behind my shoulders, the wall is cold and rough and damp, and the air smells of mildew. Our guard yanks a packet of cheap cigarettes from his breast pocket and starts a smoke. The brief illumination of the match scorches my eyes. 3:04, tick-tock. As the familiar scent of tobacco drifts across my teeth, the eyelids start to droop. The vision of Millie's pale, smooth neck starts to blur. Not ashamed to show it, Ginger. Not ashamed, Ginger. Ginger? Ginger! An elbow cracks my ribs.
Ginger, Jesus, wake up, will you?
I straighten off somebody's shoulder, adjust my jaw, blink my eyes, test my bones for doneness. You know how it is.
Ginger Kelly?
A man's voice. A man from Brooklyn or someplace. I'm afraid I don't know anyone by that name.
Tell that to the judge,
Brooklyn replies. And the next thing I know, the keys jingle-jangle, the cell clangs open, the handcuffs go snap around my wrists, and let me tell you, when a girl hears that much metal rattling around in her neighborhood, she'd better start sending up every prayer the nuns ever taught her sister, because the devil's at the door, and the Lord don't care. 6. My thoughts turn to Billy as this uniformed meathead drags me down the corridor, past this cell and that cell, contents murky and unknown. I wonder where they put the poor boy, whether they let him off because he's a marshal, whether he's frantic about me now. Of course he is. That's the kind of fellow he is. Dear Billy boy, I guess I shouldn't feel this kind of regret. After all, I didn't exactly lead him blindfolded down the path of debauchery. Debauchery found him before I did. That first kiss wasn't his first, and he knew one end of a martini glass from the other. Still, but for me, he might have spent the evening in the convivial atmosphere of his Eton Club, idly debating such innocent matters as the blackballing of unsuitable freshers and the prospects of the Tiger baseball team for the season upcoming, instead of getting himself arrested for consumption of gin. But no lovesick voice wails my name, either real or assumed, as I stumble past the cages of the 6th Precinct Station House, and when we reach the stairs at the end of the corridor, I conclude I'm simply sola, perduta, abandonata, the old story. The stairs lead rightward up to the booking desk, but Officer Brooklyn turns left instead, opening a metal door with a metal key, and the sharp garbage breath of a late January alleyway strikes my nose like a billy club. Say, what's the big idea? I demand. But Brooklyn takes no notice, just tightens his paw around my bare upper arm and hauls me up the steps to alley level, where a black sedan rattles and coughs next to the sidewalk, rear door open, exhaust cloud in the atmosphere in a great gasoline fog. And you'll forgive me for hoping that the dear, familiar head of my Billy boy will pop free from the smoke of that back seat. The final death of my native optimism is still some weeks away. But there's only room for two on the leather bench, and Brooklyn, pushing me inside, clambers in right behind me.
Go, he grunts,
and the tires squeal, and the car lurches from the curb, and my forehead hits the front seat, and nobody says sorry or even, "You all right?" Nobody offers me a cigarette or an overcoat. We just zigzag down the frozen bitter streets of the village, straightening out at 14th Street, while my teeth chatter and my brain aches, and a thousand smart remarks rise to my lips. I bite them all back, of course, because for one thing, I can tell Officer Brooklyn hasn't got the intellect to appreciate them. And for another, well, anyway, I merely observe aloud that we seem to be headed to the Hudson River piers, obvious enough, and Brooklyn grunts something or other that might mean yes or else shut your trap, and silence reoccupies the cab, except for the hum of the engine and the steam of our breath. I sit back and make myself small against the cold. When we slam to a stop outside a rusty tenement at 10th Avenue and 22nd Street, I permit myself a tick of triumph. You can hear the shouts of the stevedores, the busy clang of ocean liners obtaining coal in stores. If I'm not mistaken, those three black-tipped funnels over there, finding the moon above the triangular tips of the Chelsea docks, belong to the great RMS Majestic herself, bound for England tomorrow morning. Lucky bitch. But for now, the tenement. That's my real concern, because Officer Brooklyn is opening the door and dragging me across the seat to the crumbling sidewalk outside, and those sallow brick walls aren't looking any more inviting on second glance. An old saloon occupies the ground floor, windows all boarded up, and a few piles of hardened gray slush decorate the flagstones outside. My pretty shoes slide right out from under me. I don't think Brooklyn even notices. He just carries my weight on the slab of his right arm as I glissade across the granite. Behind us sounds the imperative whistle chug of a New York Central steam engine, hauling freight up the middle of 10th Avenue. He doesn't notice that either, just bangs on the door next to the boarded-up saloon until it opens. "Oh, no," I say. "Not on your life." Brooklyn turns his head at last. He's not a pretty fellow, our Brooklyn, all jaw and no forehead, eyes like a pair of walnuts begging for a nutcracker, shoulders about to burst from a plain uniform-type navy overcoat. The raw color of his nose and cheeks suggests either excessive cold or excessive whiskey, though you can't rule out both, or even possibly some kind of emotion. Those walnut eyes goggle almost out of his skull. And who can blame him? I'm about half his size, a third his weight. My hands are cuffed at the back, and I can't feel my toes. "I bite, you know," I add. Brooklyn shakes his head and pulls me through the doorway. A sign flashes by, one of those brass plaques, sort of tarnished, but you don't stop to read plaques when someone's hauling you into a tenement to commit the Lord only knows what foul crimes on your person. Your mind spins. Your stomach lurches. Your eyes fasten instead on inconsequential details like the rough woolen texture of Brooklyn's sleeve and the overlapping pattern of scuffs on his brown shoes and the worn-out sway in the center of each step, right where your foot goes, and the cold, moldy smell of the joint. You think, "Damn it, this might be my last sight on earth. Why can't I find something beautiful?" As if it matters. And all those taxis and fancy private automobiles will be lining up in the dawn smoke one by one to disgorge humanity onto the gangplanks of the goddamn Majestic. And no one will notice the item in the newspapers the next day about a woman found dead in a 10th Avenue tenement, some kind of prostitute, the detectives believe, and from the state of the corpse, she must have put up a good fight. Because I will, by God, put up a good fight. I'm putting up a fight right now, kicking and biting, deboning my limbs such that I slither momentarily from the shelf of Brooklyn's arm, only to be scooped up again and hauled into oblivion. But there's nothing to bite except wool and glove, nothing to kick that actually notices it's been kicked. We swing around the landing and up another flight, and I'm breathless now, panting and jabbering, while the stained walls slide past, the color of misery. Lurid bare electric bulbs, linoleum hallway, door thrown open by muscular hand, Jin thrown inside, toe catching on edge of oriental rug, crash splat. Voice like a hurricane.
What the devil, Bulo? She's not a sack of grain. She's a damned hellcat. Bit my cheek. I expect you deserved it.
Have you ever donned a narrow dress and metal handcuffs, laid yourself out flat on a beery oriental rug, and then tried to rise? Well, it's not as easy as it sounds, believe me. All the dignity of an eel on a hook. Still, I've just about got my knees under me, when a pair of hands clamps around the joints of my shoulders and lifts me straight into the air and back down on my feet, spins me around, demands a key from Brooklyn. Brooklyn delivers, though his face suggests he'd rather swallow it whole. Seems he's right. I did bite his cheek. What do you know? Fresh new blood trickles to his jaw. The handcuffs loosen. Brooklyn steps back and folds his arms across his 3-foot chest. I hate to boast, but he does look sort of mauled. Nasty scratch on the side of his neck. I stretch my wrists and wriggle my nerveless fingers and turn to face his boss, whose face bears down on mine like a mountainside. Not that I'm the kind of girl who backs down from mountains. Not me. I tap his chin with a schoolmarm finger. Tarzan, I had a hunch you were up to no good. 7. The first thing Tarzan does is return to his desk and press some kind of button. Then he rests one haunch on the desk, folds his hands together, and asks me if I want coffee. I say, why not? Door opens, feminine voice makes inquiry. Coffee for Miss Kelly, please. Door closes. No word from Brooklyn. Maybe he's gone. Tarzan gestures stage left.
Please sit down, Miss Kelly. I expect you're exhausted.
No, thanks. I'd rather stand.
You're certain?
Quite. Is this your office? I love what you've done with the place. All those padded armchairs and old masters, and that thrilling modern wallpaper. Or have you got a leak?
It's a place of employment, not a parlor.
Oh, employment. I'm glad you mentioned it. What exactly is your line of work, Mr. Tarzan?
My name is Anson.
Mr. Anson.
And my job, put simply, is to intercept the illegal transportation and sale of intoxicating liquors.
Lord Almighty, you're a revenue agent. He shrugs. Well, that's a relief. I can confidently say that you've got the wrong girl, Agent Anson. I'm more in the consumption line, if you know what I mean. Transportation and sale is not my concern.
Not at the moment, maybe, he says, but it will be.
Now, see, that's just exactly what I didn't want you to say.
Your choice, of course, but I do hope you'll help us. Good. Here's the coffee.
Thank the Lord for the pause that ensues, allows me to haul in my breath, corral the runaway gallop of my heartbeat, wipe my palms on my sequins while everyone's turned to the poor young secretary in the navy suit and cream blouse who carries in the coffee on an old enamel tray, the kind your parents might have brought out to entertain callers in a more civilized age. As it turns out, Brooklyn hasn't left the room after all. He's taken a chair near the door, a poor spindly thing that shudders under his weight. The chair, I mean, not the door. I take my cup, cream, one lump, and carry it to the seat I refused earlier, which looks as if it were bought cheap from the shuttered saloon downstairs.
Are you cold, Miss Kelly?
Anson asks as the door closes behind the minion. Not at all.
You look blue.
I'm just mad. He removes his jacket, walks around behind me, swings the old thing over my shoulders. I consider shrugging it off, just on principle, but a jacket like that trumps any principle you care to possess. Wholesome silk lining, sensuous warmth, scent of shaven soap. Is there anything more delicious than a gentleman's wool coat cloaked around your shoulders, even when the gentleman's not yours?
Why are you angry? He asks, returning to the desk.
Let me count the ways. He casts a cool look in Brooklyn's direction.
I apologize for my methods.
As you should. I'm bruised all over. I'd show you where if I weren't a lady.
But aside from the physical harm.
Oh, aside from little old that.
I had no choice. I couldn't just ask you to come of your own free will. You wouldn't have agreed for one thing. And frankly, I needed a little of what the financiers call leverage.
Leverage? He places a thumb next to the corner of his mouth and brushes away an imaginary something or other.
Mr. Marshall.
Billy, what have you done with Billy?
He's not in any danger. Not at the moment, anyway.
You've got no right. He's as innocent as a lamb.
A lamb. And you, Miss Kelly, are you innocent as a lamb?
I have the feeling you already know the answer to that. I'm as innocent as the next girl, I guess.
Anson gives the sealant some mature consideration.
Now, see here, Mr. Anson. We both know you've got no business persecuting a working girl like me for taking a sip or two of this and that. I'm not the crook. It's those gangsters out there on the Lincoln Highway in the middle of the night. It's that hillbilly with a dozen stills blowing off the roof of his barn.
Snap go the fingers on Anson's right hand.
Is that so, Miss Kelly? Hillbillies? What do you know about hillbillies?
I could swear the light bulb flickers in its socket above my head. But maybe it's just the light bulb going off inside my head. The Jesus Mary, Jin, you dumb cluck, hollering up from my unconscious mind. The part of your head that does all your best thinking, everybody says. Too late now. Outside the window, New York lies nice and quiet. The dark night speckled with various pinpricks of human activity.
Of people not giving a damn what happens here in this room at this particular hour of the 24.
A few feet away, Anson's granite face stares and stares, no expression whatsoever, calm as you please. Just a word. But what a word. Hillbillies, Ms. Kelly. What do you know about hillbillies?
Nothing, I lie. Nothing at all. Nope. Because you sounded just now like a woman who knows something.
I'm a working girl, Mr. Anson. A New York working girl. I get my news like everyone else. The morning paper. You can learn a lot about the world from the morning paper, but it doesn't mean you know one single mite more than the next girl.
Anson shifts position, leaning back against the desk, both hands curled around the edge. It's the kind of angle that displays the girth of his quadriceps to their absolute maximus, such that you imagine they might rip free from all that civilized wool and sock you in the stomach. Absent a coat, his shirt sleeves show up like snow in the gray dark room. I would say there's something colorless about him altogether, like he's put on a mask of ice, that good, thick Adirondack ice they haul down from those lakes upstate. You could pick and pick and never draw blood. A fine pair we are. The coffee cup sits untouched on his left side, sending up steam.
But every New York working girl comes from somewhere. Doesn't she, Miss Kelly?
He lifts one hand away from the desk and gestures to the window.
Nobody's born here.
That's not true. A lot of girls are born here.
Not you. You're a country girl, aren't you? The far end of Maryland, isn't that right? Small town called River Junction, I believe.
At this point, the edges of the room go a little dark. I'd like to take a sip of coffee, poor thing's getting cold, sitting there in my lap like that. But I'm afraid my hand will tremble.
So I just clench the handle with my right thumb and forefinger, while I clench the saucer with the left. Sew my lips into a smile. Focus my vision on the tip of Anson's oversized nose. The cleft at the tip of his damn chin, chipped from ice.
He moves. Picks up his coffee with a steady hand. Sips. Savors. Savors what? I don't know. It's just black coffee, nothing else. You have to be a brute to drink coffee like that. a brute as bitter as the brew you're swallowing.
"Tell me, Miss Kelly," he says, setting down the cup in the saucer and resuming his pose against the desk, legs crossed at the ankles, not a care in the world. "When was the last time you saw your stepfather?"
8. As it so happens, I can name the exact hour I last saw my stepfather, though I'm not going to inform Special Agent Oliver Anson of the Bureau of Internal Revenue of that fact. I'm not going to inform Anson of anything. See, because the word informer, where I come from, carries about the same ugly weight of blasphemy as the word for a man who engages in a certain intimate act with his nearest maternal relation from time to time. Yes, that word. So what I'm about to say remains right here betwixt you and me, understand? Nobody likes a rat. The hour was dawn, end of August 1920, hot as the dickens. Yours truly was up early, gathering the eggs from the miserable henhouse out back, while the sunlight crept down the mountainside and the warm mist coated the grass. In another week, I was supposed to be heading back to college, and by God, I should have been counting down the seconds. Not that I especially loved college and the sneering razor-nosed girls who inhabited the joint, oh no. You see, by the time of that burn in August of 1920, River Junction had taken on all the aspects of an earthly perdition for me. That's why I woke up early, not because the eggs needed gathering, although they did, but because nobody else was up. You could stand there in the middle of the chicken coop and watch the creeping of the sun, the stir of the mist, the slow, deliberate greening of the landscape. And your only company was the hens. The birds whistling good morning from the branches of a nearby birch, the damp earth smelling of loam and chicken shit. You know the feeling. Your feet planted firm in the center of all creation. Until he turned up anyway. He. Him. My mother's husband. Name of Dennis, but everybody calls him Duke. Duke Kelly. The dear soul was so kind as to bequeath me his surname when he married my mother, and I do believe he's been aiming to collect the debt in installments ever since. Now, first and foremost, you have to understand that everybody in River Junction loves Duke. Loves him. He's not the mayor, but he's the next closest thing. The mayor's best pal. Friendly fellow. Every brick of him mortared with charm. Dresses in clean, neat clothes, brushes back his dark, curling mane with just the right dollop of peppermint hair oil. You'd like him, too, if you happen to be stopping in River Junction for a cup of coffee at the Depot Cafe, and he happened to be sitting at the next table, drinking his own cup of coffee and smoking a cigarette he'd rolled himself right then. He would strike up a conversation with you, ask you where you were headed, tell you that's a right nice-looking car you got out there. Or else, if your car's a jalopy, remark on your right nice-looking wife. Offer you a cigarette and a light. If you needed directions, say, he would sit down with you and your map and show you the exact best route to your destination, where to pick up a couple gallons of gas if you need them, and you would leave town thinking that River Junction was an awful nice place. Nice people. That's what's grand about America, don't you think? Small towns like River Junction and the folks who live there. Salt of the earth. And I'm not saying you'd be wrong. So I was standing in the chicken coop, as I said, basking of eggs, hooked over my elbow, armpits a little damp already, even though the sun hadn't yet touched us, there in the holler of two mountains that constitutes the geographic boundaries of River Junction. I heard the soft tread of footsteps on wet grass, the wiry squeak of the chicken coop door. My stomach fell. "Hello there, Geneva Rose," he said. "You's up awful early this morning."
"Eggs wanted gathering."
"That's so."
"Every morning."
"You need a hand, maybe?"
"No, thanks."
"Let me give you a hand.
I said no thanks. I like to stand out by myself in the morning."
"Well, now, that ain't too friendly, honey."
I shrugged.
"Why don't you just turn about and look at me, Geneva Rose? Turn about and say good morning to your old daddy."
"You ain't my daddy," I said. But I turned around anyway, kind of slow, so I might fix my face in just the right expression as I went. Stiff and stony, so he couldn't see what I was thinking. Couldn't tell the revulsion coiling around my guts at the sight of his shining hair, his smooth tan skin, his blue eyes like the color of summer. His full lips stretched in a smile, just wide enough that you could see the tips of his teeth, golden with tobacco. Right upper incisor chipped at the corner from a fall out the saloon door 4 years back. Or that was the story, anyway. I never was there when it happened.
"You ain't got no call to speak to me like that, Geneva Rose Kelly, when I reared you up like you was my own. Sent you off to school like your mama wanted. Never asked no questions. Never treated you no different."
Well, I could dissect the falsehoods in that speech one by one, the way they taught me in college. How to disassemble somebody's argument like you might disassemble a chicken for frying. Not that any of the other girls at college had ever fried a chicken, my goodness no, let alone pucked it and pieced it and dipped it in flour. But I didn't pick those words apart, not out loud. Dear listener, I am no idiot. And I appreciate that kindness, Duke, I really do, but I'm not your daughter, and that's a fact. And I never was any good at pretending things that aren't true.
"Just listen to you, baby girl, sounding like some kind of lady, like one of them grammar books or something. You learn to talk that way at college? You set to thinking you're too good for your old daddy?"
"Course not."
"Because that's how it sounds to me, Geneva Rose."
"Well, that ain't how it is."
"Now that's better."
He nodded and reached for my cheek.
"That's more like my baby girl. You was but 2 years old when I laid eyes on you, when your mama come back home from New York City. Prettiest baby I ever seen."
I turned my head away, took a step back. The smell of his hair oil stung my nostrils, the smell of his shaven soap. He wore a blue-checked shirt, same color as his eyes, tucked into dungarees held high by plain black suspenders. Sweat already beading at his temples. Lips red and damp.
"Don't you go a-larkin' off, baby girl," he crooned. "Ain't nobody up here exceptin' you and me. Your mama's still abed.
She won't be long."
"Sure she will, sugar. She don't rise herself up till noon sometimes. Just a-drinkin' and a-starin' at the ceilin', your mama."
His breath smelled like cigarettes. Wee dram of brown ski, too, if I wasn't mistaken. Liquid courage, to use another word for it, which maybe explained what he was doing there in that chicken coop, in the thick August dawn, while my mother slept in her bed. 1 week less a day before I should have been leaving for my second year of college.
"Baby girl," he said, "don't you be shy now. I'll treat you right. You know I will. I treat everybody right that treats me right."
"I think you best be fixin' to get back inside that house, Duke Kelly," I said, edging to the right. Clear line for the frail wire-screened door of the coop. The patch of sun on the opposite slope was falling fast now, the air turning to a foggy gold. "You best fix to get back inside before somebody sees you out here."
"Who's a-gonna see us? Ain't nobody up. Not on a hot old morning like this'un."
I kept on staring at his nose without looking, imagining some kind of shade between our two faces. I guess some kind of blind, so I wouldn't be giving myself away. Another rightward step. "Johnny's up, I reckon. Johnny's always up early."
"Johnny don't know from nothing. Now just you stop yourself from moving about like that, Geneva Rose. Let me get a look at you. See how you filled out this summer. Almost a woman grown now, ain't you? Just almost."
So I froze up, and you would too if you'd heard his voice like that, like the purr of an African cat, chilling your young bones from the inside out, worrying down your spine. Or maybe you wouldn't. Maybe I'm the only one who hears that bass snarl of malice in Duke Kelly's voice. Everybody else just thinks he's a real nice fellow. Anyway, I froze up. Paralysis of fear, muscles all stuck in their joints,
such that I didn't even flinch when Duke's big hand came to rest on the collar of my dress.
"That's better," he said. "That's my good baby girl." I waited and waited, while that hand crawled all over my bosom, pinching and squeezing, while that voice crawled over my ears. I waited until he came in close with his mouth open, panting hot on my face, cheeks smudged red. And then I drove my fist into his stomach hard as I could, knocking his rank ski breath right from his belly. And then I ran straight through the door of that chicken coop, ripping the wire, ripping my skin. And then I did a stupid thing. See, I should have gone into the house where Mama and the boys lay asleep, where Johnny sat eating his porridge at the kitchen table, spoon by spoon with a drop of molasses. But I was so scared I wasn't thinking straight. I ran for the creek instead, dumb bunny as I was back then. Ran for the creek and the old fishing hole where we used to spend our summer afternoons, me and the boys, when I was home from school. Of course, the creek was screened by willows and thick with skeeters. And nobody came down there at that time of day, nobody at all. And you couldn't hear nobody talking or screaming from down there either, on account of the trees and the way the creek makes a holler betwixt two sloping banks, see, into which all these sounds find themselves trapped like crawdads at the bottom of a wooden barrel. So why did I make for the creek? God knows. Just a young, dumb bunny as I was back then. Not thinking straight. 9. Anyway, I'm nobody's bunny any longer. What I tell that nice special revenue agent is this. "I'm afraid I don't recollect exactly, Mr. Anson. Why do you ask?" "You've had no relations at all with your family since you left River Junction in the summer of 1920.
"Say, that's a personal question."
He shrugs those shoulders of his, checks his wristwatch, sips coffee, sighs, turns his head to the window as if to make certain that Manhattan still exists out there, rattling and shouting and drinking and fornicating. A delicate glow passes across the bridge of that hefty nose, headlights of some nocturnal automobile.
"Have on that, do you?" I say.
"If necessary."
"My goodness, is old Duke so important as that?"
"Yes."
"Can't you give me a hint?"
He turns back to me. "Do I need to give you a hint? You seem like a clever woman, Miss Kelly. I'm sure you've already guessed the nature of my interest in your stepfather."
"I haven't laid eyes on River Junction in nearly 3.5 years, Mr. Anson. If my stepfather set himself up in a little business since then, taking advantage of the difference between what one half of the country wants and what the other half doesn't want them to get, why, I don't know a thing about it."
Anson places his cup and saucer back on the desk and walks across the few yards of thready oriental carpet to where I sit in my chair, all folded shut like a clam at low tide. The silk lining over my shoulders responds with an electric ripple, or maybe that's the nerves underneath. Each button of Anson's plain waistcoat is done right up, not a stitch loose, not a single flaw in the weave of fine gray wool. And the reason I can report these details is because he's come to rest about a foot away. Not even that. I do expect I can tell you the brand of starch stiffen in the cuffs of his sleeves. From this angle, his head looks like a prehistoric skull, all bone. He sinks to one knee, right there next to my chair, and lays his right forearm over his thigh. His eyes are larger than I thought, more charcoal than blue. The color of winter.
"Not a little business, Miss Kelly. Your stepfather has built a network of distilleries across Allegheny County and beyond, and nobody will say a word against him. I don't know if they love the man or if they're plain scared, or if they're on the take."
"All three, I do expect."
"In 2 years, the Bureau hasn't been able to make a dent in his business, not a single arrest. A few months ago, 2 of our best men disappeared out there."
"My condolences.
What's the world coming to when a pro he can't just take a little lettuce in his back pocket and keep his blood on the inside?
My agents don't accept bribes, Miss Kelly.
You don't say. Because a little birdie tells me they'd be the first.
They're good men, with families, wives and children.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have a wife and children, Mr. Anson?
A slow blink, like a reptile.
That's a personal question, Miss Kelly.
Oh, I see. I'm the one who's supposed to spill all the beans in this room. Isn't that right? Why, you get to keep your beans to yourself. Seems you got a nice little racket of your own, Anson. A nice little racket.
He breathes in slow, regular drafts from a pair of gargantuan lungs. Fresh coffee on his breath and nothing else. Not tobacco, nor liquor, nor money. Just good, clean virtue.
You see, it's all a matter of perspective, isn't it? There was this painter I used to sleep with when I first came to New York. A real Weisenheimer. He taught me about a lot of things. He taught me all about perspective. How you can change the essence of an object, the soul of it. You can change this thing entirely just by looking on it some different way. But you know what? I'll bet you already knew that. Something tells me you know a lot about art, don't you, Mr. Anson? The expensive art. The kind they hang in museums and fancy Fifth Avenue apartments. You know from perspective, I'll bet.
I understand the concept.
You think you're the good guy, don't you, Mr. Anson? You think you're some kind of honest-to-goodness knight, riding into River Junction on your fine white charger to do away with that dastardly villain with the twirling mustache. Cover yourself with medals, laurels on your head, damsels on your arm. I wonder what you'd say if you knew how it looks from where I'm sitting.
So tell me.
I turn a little on my hip on that chair so we're face to face, terribly intimate. The way you turn to your lover in bed. Prop my elbow on the back of the chair, drape one leg over the other. His knee's no more than an inch from my own. Why? You look exactly the same. You and my stepfather. You take me by surprise, haul me to your lair, corner me where I can't strike back, hold someone dear over my head just to make sure I play along. You and Duke, you just want to get a little something out of me, whether I like it or not, and you don't ever mean to pay me back for my trouble. Well, if I was hoping to get a little flicker out of him, some sign of impact, forget it. You might as well chip a motion from a glacier. Just those wintry eyes staring at me. Those fingers hanging downward from his thigh, thick and knobbled. Scar on his chin, on his forehead. Lashes black and plentiful. The room throbs around us. The city throbs around the room. A block or two away, the boat skates silently across the Hudson River, hauling in booze. Hauling in contraband, everything in an unstoppable swarm. Like the skeeters back home. Too small and quick and clever for you to swat. Without warning, the fingers flex. A few quick strikes like the twitches of a dying man.
I have neither wife nor children, Ms. Kelly, he says. Your turn.
All right. Here's my turn. Duke Kelly's a cold-blooded bastard, and I'll turn myself in at the nearest precinct before I trundle back to River Junction like some poor sucker and help you catch him.
I see. And what if you're not the poor sucker heading for jail?
Then I don't give a damn either way.
Are you sure about that? Isn't there someone in this town you care about?
He leans forward an inch or two and says, low and slow,
someone, even now, enjoying the hospitality of the New York City Police Department.
You mean Billy. He doesn't answer that. Why should he? Just returns my stare. Exchanges my breath for his. I'll say one thing. He's got a handsome set of eyelashes, the only soft thing about him. So light at the tips. I want to dust them with my pinky finger ever so gently. For some reason, this idea soothes the pulse at the base of my neck, the one that has a nervous tendency to gallop off like a runaway horse at the mention of my stepfather's name. The ringing clears from my eardrums. Thoughts fall back into place. Bright, crisp, useful little thoughts. "Now, Mr. Anson, we both know you can't make a thing stick to my Billy boy. Don't you know what family he belongs to? The Marshalls?" There is a slight pause.
"I have an idea."
"Pillars of society. Patrons of every charity between here and Albany. Pals with every pole at every poker table in town. All Billy has to do is make a telephone call to dear old Patter, and he's a free man. Why, I'll bet you a bottle of genuine Dewars. He's a free man already. Trundling on back to Princeton, New Jersey this minute, in the back seat of Patter's Packard limousine. What do you say to that?" Anson shoots straight to the ceiling, plants his hands on his hips, ignites the nerves behind his eyeballs, parts his lips like he's got a lot to say to that sister, and none of it good. But the seconds tick on, one after another, and nothing comes out from between those two poised lips. Just the furious whir of second thoughts in the tumblers of his brain. Then the slow unstiffening of the muscles of his face. Not what you'd call movement. Not even a change of expression. He hasn't got any of those, remember? But a kind of deflation. A loosening of the skin. Maybe his shoulders sink a little, I don't know. But the eyes stay bright.
"I guess I'd say you're probably right about that."
"So you got nothing?"
"Maybe I don't."
"In fact, I do believe this entire hullabaloo constitutes nothing more than a bluff on your part. Doesn't it, Mr. Anson? Be honest now. Just a noisy show to try and scare a poor working girl who's done nothing worse tonight than order herself a glass of honest sweet milk from the wrong establishment." Long, lazy pause, like the ocean holding its breath before the turn of the tide. And then, so quiet, it's almost a whisper.
"If that's what you want to call it."
I rise slowly, untangling my legs as I go, allowing my skirt to fall back into place and my limbs to lengthen. I cross my hands behind my back and keep on rising, right up to my tiptoes, so my nose nearly brushes the brute end of Mr. Anson's chin. "Why, if I wanted to raise a big stink, I could take this whole affair straight to the top, couldn't I? I could show off all my bruises, weep and wring my little old hands. If Billy were to hear of this, for example..." I shrug my shoulders, such that Mr. Anson's silk-lined jacket slides across my skin. He stares down his nose and mutters,
"Good old Billy."
"Yes. So what do you say we come to a little arrangement, Mr. Anson? A little proposal of my own?"
"What kind of arrangement, Miss Kelly?"
"So simple, even an honest fellow like you can understand it. It's like this. You take me home this minute, and I promise not to give Billy Marshall your name." 10. Anson drives me back to Christopher Street himself. He doesn't say much, just busies himself with the matter of negotiating the narrow, cold streets, the patches of slush and garbage. The buildings are tense and shuttered, as if laid under siege. The brakes squeal faintly in front of the Italian grocery. "What have you done with Christopher?" I ask.
"Christopher?"
I jerk my head. "The owner." Anson's thumbs meet at the top of the steering wheel.
"I expect he'll have to go up in front of a judge, pay a fine."
"And what about me? Do I have to see a judge?"
"No. You're free. For now, anyway."
I look over his shoulder through the window. It's begun to snow, the minute tender flakes at the Vanguard. You know he'll be back in business tomorrow night, a week at the most.
"I know that. It's not him I'm concerned with.
You can't stop any of it. You'll die trying.
Maybe I will.
A fellow wants a drink. He's going to have it.
Anson lifts his hands from the wheel and sets the brake, reaches inside the pocket of his overcoat, and produces a calling card.
You'll telephone me if you change your mind.
If I change my mind, why, sure.
Take the card, then.
I don't need to. I tap my forehead.
Now that's funny. An hour ago you couldn't scarcely remember your own name. Now you've got a photographic memory.
When I need it.
He presses the card into my hand.
Take it anyway, in case someone knocks you on the head and gives you a spell of amnesia.
Does that happen often in your line of work?
All the time.
I pinch the Ouija board between my two fingers and study it again. The plain Roman letters. Oliver Anson. Exchange a number. By the time I'm finished, Anson's opened the door of the automobile and strode around the hood to let me out.
Thanks. I can find my way from here.
I'm escorting you inside, Miss Kelly.
No, you're not.
Statistically speaking, it's the most dangerous time of night.
No kidding. Then I guess I must be statistically dead by now.
He shuts the car door behind me and straightens. His gaze falls on my chin, which sticks right out there into the Manhattan night, and an angle those nuns used to abhor.
All right. Good night, Miss Kelly. Thank you for your time.
Don't mention it.
My shoes slip and clatter on the paving stones. The headlights flare against the glitter of my dress, against the tiny whir of snowflakes. I reach the sidewalk and the door, pull out my latchkey like any modern, independent girl in New York City. The snow coats the stoop like a layer of dust, and mine are the first footprints. The knob turns, and I remember something.
Anson, your jacket!
Keep it.
I shrug the garment from my shoulders and trip back down across the sidewalk to where Anson stands next to the driver's side door, in his overcoat and a plaid muffler, probably cashmere wool, like the girls at college used to wear, only sleeker. Hat pulled down low over that slanting forehead. The car's parked right in the middle of two street lamps, nice and dark, so I can't see his face all that well.
I say, no, you take it. Or else you'll be coming back for it, won't you? And that wouldn't do at all.
He takes the jacket and folds it over his arm, while the snow stings my bare skin and lands in my hair. And you know something? For a single, crazy instant, I imagine myself asking him upstairs, you know, for a cup of coffee or something, chase away the winter. Anson nods, like he's imagining the same thing. His hand reaches out to land on my shoulder, and the leather feels wet on my skin, cold, the fresh, sweet meltwater of New York snowflakes.
Now get inside before you freeze to death.
11. I suppose you imagine, after a night like that, I'd be looking forward to a long winter's nap in my own clean bed, and I am. I might sleep all February if you let me. But I can't, you see, because in the first place, I'm shortly due at a tapping pool in the underwriting department of Sterling Bates and Company, on the corner of Wall and Broad, come snow or come revenue agents. And second of all, the light shining forth from underneath my door. And it turns out, Special Agent Anson was wrong, after all.
12. Darling, Billy, words end in oomph against the lapels of Billy's dinner jacket. Darling, I've been worried sick into my hair. Where have you been? I telephoned the precinct. I telephoned everyone I could think of.
You telephone what?
Extracting self from lapels.
Dearest love.
He takes my face between his hands and kisses my mouth. His breath smells of cigarettes and scotch whiskey and anxiety.
Did they hurt you? If anyone hurt you,
nobody hurt me.
That agent, the agent who called in the raid. What about him?
He didn't try anything, did he?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Billy holds me out at arm's length, which is to say, about the length of the entire room, and examines my eyes for truth.
But